This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford. Coming up, blacks in Toronto, Canada say the Canadian police are just as racist as cops in the United States. The Black Is Back Coalition prepares for a national conference in Newark, New Jersey. And a new book says Manning Marable got it mostly wrong about Malcolm X. But first, the Republican-dominated government of Pennsylvania has eliminated most cash assistance to single poor people, payments of about $200 a month. About 70,000 people were cut off with virtually no notice, many of them disabled and unable to work. State Representative W. Curtis Thomas is a Democrat from a district in Philadelphia.
The governor maintains that we need to cut back on services in response to this economic recession, and that Pennsylvania healthcare costs was going up so high till they had to deal with this issue. Since this governor became governor of Pennsylvania, he has cut out the adult health insurance program. And his next step is with about five categories of people who was receiving cash assistance. The categories is 18 to 44 and single. Governor believes that those people do not need cash assistance. Secondly, if you're 13 and under and living with someone who is not a family member, then you will not receive cash assistance. And I don't think the governor understands that many young people under the age of 13 that's living with non-family members are probably there because family members might be drug addicted, or one of the other things that we've been witnessing here in Philadelphia, and that is a lot of parents who have died because of AIDS or HIV, and so kids are left abandoned. And non-family members who are more compassionate about these kids than the governor.
And these young people would effectively be homeless were it not for this rather measly $200 a month.
Right. Drug and alcohol addicted and disabled people who should be on Social Security, but because of bureaucracy has not been on Social Security and therefore are surviving off of the little amount of cash assistance that they receive from Pennsylvania. Because of the pressure that we applied and others applied, the governor backed off of his July 1 termination of 70,000 people. Cash assistance has been extended to August the 1st.
The Department of Public Welfare tried to stop social workers from telling folks that they might like to call their representative.
Right, because they wanted to hold their numbers down. And I think the other reason that the governor had to back up is because the Department of Public Welfare had not sent out notices to people. So people were going to look up on July 1 or whatever day they received their cash assistance and find out that there is no longer any cash assistance.
And clearly that would be to head off any kind of protest.
Right. That's one thing. But the other thing is, one of the reasons that the governor wanted this budget done and his party wanted this budget done as quickly as possible so that we do not have to deal with over-expected revenues for the month of June. As you know, revenue projections for April and May was almost $1 billion, over $750 million in unexpected revenues. We believe that June's revenues are going to be better than what has been projected. And so one of the things that we're looking towards is doing a supplemental appropriation in September, as soon as we return, to deal with emergency situations. Because the reality is just because you want to go on to Social Security and are disabled, the bureaucracy can be aggravating. And so anybody that should be on Social Security and currently on cash assistance should be continued until Social Security has been approved. And there are other populations, women who've been victims of domestic violence, they should be able to maintain that limited assistance until we can get something worked out. But the other thing I think you should be aware of is you look at Republican governors across the country, and especially in states where general assemblies are dominated by the Republican Party, you will find efforts underway to do asset testing on young people and seniors. Here in Pennsylvania, seniors will not be able to get food stamps, no matter how bad they need them, without undergoing this asset test. Secondly, there are populations of people who are wholesale being removed from the public assistance rolls. Thirdly, for those who are in the TANF program, you got states like Pennsylvania that's now talking about maybe loaning the cash assistance so that you have to pay it back when you go back to work. But while we're doing all of that, you have the governor and the Republican General Assembly who is breaking their necks to give Shell Oil Company $66 million to locate here in Pennsylvania. You got the same people who are giving drillers almost carte blanche access to drilling in Pennsylvania for this Marcellus Shell and other energy-related resources that people believe is in the state of Pennsylvania. So while we're throwing people in the street on one hand, we are fattening corporate welfare at an alarming rate in Pennsylvania.
The governor's rationale is that they have to cut back because there's a recession, but this program, like so many others, was put in place during the Great Depression with the idea that when times are hard, people need assistance.
And then the governor and the Republican General Assembly, in the back of their minds, they believe that most of these people on these programs are stealing and committing fraud, okay? So while on one side they say that we're still dealing with economic hard times, but at the same time, they believe that most of these people are out there doing something that they're not supposed to do, so we need to get them off the rolls anyway.
And there's a heavy racial overtone in that.
Right. Very much so. In most of these states where you're making these harsh decisions, you find that they're trying to balance budgets on the backs of poor people, while at the same time, they're trying to gain name recognition and influence by enhancing corporate welfare. So you're making the rich richer, and you're creating aggravating situations for people who are poor.
Pennsylvania state lawmaker W. Curtis Thomas in Philadelphia. Toronto, Canada, has a non-white majority and a police force that some blacks say practices systematic racial profiling. Odion Fayalo is part of a group called Justice is Not Colorblind, a youth activist organization demanding an end to police abuse of Toronto's blacks. He says justice is definitely not colorblind in Canada's largest city.
The justice system actually is such that it targets racialized people. You know, the whole lady with the blindfold and the scales of justice, we're saying that the blindfold is off. And this is why we see an overrepresentation of black people that are being incarcerated, that are being targeted by police. The Justice is Not Colorblind campaign is saying that we want the justice system to be fair to black people.
In practice, you're saying that in Toronto, racial profiling is rampant.
Yes, oh my goodness. Racial profiling is very rampant in Toronto. It's similar to what's going on in the States, actually, with stop and frisk. Black men here are carded. So carding is a thing where the police would stop you, whether you're riding your bike or driving a car or you're walking with a group of friends. And they'll ask you for your ID. They'll take your name and your information, et cetera. And if you're with a group of people, they'll call you guys associates. And the thing is, what happens with that information is it's typed into a database. And there's no rules as to what happens to this information. The information's in the system indefinitely. What they do is they use that as intelligence for whenever crimes are committed in the city. And they got your name and then the people that you're with, which they characterize as associates. There was an overrepresentation of black men that were being carded in all of the patrol zones in the city. Even if black people weren't heavily populated in those neighborhoods, in those patrol zones, black people were still overrepresented in those patrol zones. So racial profiling is very rampant in the city of Toronto.
These associates, that black folks who hang together are associates, that sounds like a gang database that they're assembling.
It does. The whole notion of being known to police, right? It's very vague, but it has negative connotations. It does suggest that the database is a gang-type database that they're trying to put together.
In the States, we call that criminalizing black people as a class.
It's the same here in Toronto, Glenn. The more police means more arrests, more convictions. It's just a growing system of criminalization and control of the black community. It's about the control of those without property. And that's why the Justice is Not Colorblind campaign, we're attempting to counteract that through our demands.
Well, tell us what those demands are, please.
Our first demand is that we want an end to TAVIS and racial profiling and carding. TAVIS is the Toronto Anti-Violence Intervention Strategy that was created in 2006 after the supposed Summer of the Gun in 2005. And the Summer of the Gun was a term coined for 2005 because Toronto had 80 homicides and 50 of them were gun-related. And most of them were young black men that were shot by young black men. So this media dubbed it Summer of the Gun. The Ministry of Community Safety here at the provincial level gave the Toronto Police $5 million to create this strategy under the guise of community engagement. So we want an end to that program because it's really a way of intelligence gathering and criminalizing the community. Our second demand is we want an end to sweeps and raids of the community. Every so often, you'll hear about the Toronto Police just going into the community, the black community, and just raiding it, gathering whole peoples. In fact, a few years ago, there was a project that they did where they sweeped up people, and they were left so long in the justice system in terms of getting bail that the judge actually awarded the people that were in the system money for compensation for their time being left in the jails pending bail hearing because the system was so backed up with people that they have just swept up in the raid. So we want to end the sweeps and raids of the community. And sweeps and raids have also been shown to destabilize the community as well because what ends up happening is there's a power vacuum and somebody fills that power vacuum, more quote-unquote gangs, and it creates reactionary violence in the community. So it ends up destabilizing it. So it's a horrible strategy, and morally and legally, it's not even justified either. Our third demand is we want compensation for all the families of people of police killings. The families need to be compensated of those that have been killed by the police. So many people have been killed by the Toronto Police. And the Special Investigations Unit, which is a supposedly civilian oversight body, never lays charges against police. And if they do, they don't get convicted. Our fourth demand, we actually want the criminalization of the practice of racial profiling.
You see racial profiling as a hate crime in itself.
Yes. We're trying to expand the whole notion about hate crimes. We believe hate crimes are actually being committed by the state, the governmental institutions against black people. It's a genocidal attack that's being waged upon us. And we're trying to expand that whole notion, because that's not the first thing you think of when you think of hate crime, that what the police are engaged in is actually a hate crime against the whole people. But it is. We're being systematically attacked. I don't know what else it would be other than a hate crime. We want the arrest and prosecutions, actually, of those police officers. That's part of our fourth demand, because we believe practice of racial profiling is criminal. And our fifth demand is that we want an end to what we characterize as the incestuous relationships between the Attorney General and the SIU, which I spoke about, and the police services in our province. We want the SIU, which is the civilian oversight body that, you know, when the police shoot somebody or something, they come in, but it's full of ex-cops. So it's taken on a whole police culture. It's not really a civilian oversight because it's full of ex-cops. So we want that civilian body to actually be civilians from a non-law enforcement background. And then on top of that, we want community control over the SIU to keep the SIU in check. Those are our five demands in a nutshell.
What has been the stance of traditional black leadership in Toronto regarding police abuses?
The strongest line in Toronto has been from the Black Action Defense Committee and Dudley Laws. He actually passed away in 2011. Dudley Laws represented the strongest line against the police service here in Toronto. Him and his organization were very militant. They've been around for over 20 years, fighting on the front lines, speaking out against police brutality, speaking against racial profiling. In fact, Dudley Laws said at the time that the Toronto Police Service was the worst police service in all of North America. And this was the 80s and 90s when police were just gunning down young black men in Toronto with impunity. Black Action is actually where the Justice Is Not Colorblind campaign, we actually work out of their office. We're actually a youth-driven organization. It's primarily youth that are functioning as Justice Is Not Colorblind campaign, but the Black Action Defense Committee and the Rights Watch Network as well have been providing ideological support and other supports to us.
To the extent that Americans have any impression of Canada, it is that the police are not as brutal and not as racist, but I suppose that is a misperception.
Yes. In Canada, we're talking about a population, we're 2.5% of the population of over 30 million people. And that's the black population. So there's not a lot of black people in Canada.
But proportionately, there are a lot of black people in Toronto.
Exactly. In Toronto and in the province of Ontario, proportionately, this is where most black people reside. And that's why we're seeing the police move in the way in the black neighborhoods in our city. There are very dense populations. If you're talking about Jane and Finch, Jamestown, these are just different neighborhoods in our city that are full of African people. So proportionally, yes, we reside in Toronto. Our American brothers and sisters should definitely understand that Canada is no different. It's just as violent as the New York Police Department or any other police department. It's just as corrupt, too. There were just recent convictions of Toronto police officers that were on a drug squad that were stealing money from people, etc. So, I mean, it's just as corrupt as well as any other police service that you can point to in the United States.
Blacks in Canada come from all over the world. Does this create problems in organizing, or does it represent a strength?
I think it's both. That diversity helps us in the sense that we get different perspectives, so it maintains a balance. But there are contentions, for instance, when you're dealing with people that have just immigrated. Most of us, we were born in the Caribbean or someplace in Africa, immigrated to Canada when we were young or recently. And if you're dealing with newly arrived people, you do have to contend with that. And just the whole notion of blackness as well. Some people don't even identify, that are black, don't identify as black. That's not a predominant identity for them. So they may not equate that they're going through the same struggle as everybody else, even though they are. The police are just as vicious with them as whoever. The police don't see a distinction between a Somalian or a Jamaican or a Trinidadian or whatever you identify as. They see black, right? And they see poor. So we have to contend with that, and that's actually something that we're dealing with right now with our mobilization project that we're putting on the ground in Regent Park. It's our summer mobilization and organizing project. It's a heavily black Somalian community. It's split between Jamaican and Somalian. So we have to contend with those identities and try to navigate in such a way as to, you know, engage, for instance, the Somalian community, where some blackness is not really a predominant identity. It may be that they're Somalian, for instance, or Muslim, or whatever, if one is religiously oriented. So we're planning and strategizing how to deal with that, and we're trying to reach out to leaders in the Somalian community to get in terms of our programming. We're trying to spark something here in Toronto because the black political landscape is so moderate that we need people that can hold a line, a strong line.
Odion Fayalo of Justice Is Not Colorblind in Toronto.
Last year, the late Dr. Manning Marable came out with his last book, Malcolm X, A Life of Reinvention, which hit the bookstores days after his death. A new book is about to be released that maintains Marable distorted Malcolm's life and politics. Dr. Jared Ball of Morgan State University is one of the contributors to A Lie of Reinvention, correcting Manning Marable's Malcolm X.
For me, one of the most glaring examples of Marable's struggles to diagnose Malcolm's real politics is his consistent inability to confront directly his subject's final mass organizational political act, the establishment of the Organization of Afro-American Unity. The way Marable writes about the OAAU, along with many other things about Malcolm X, again, is very nuanced and skillful and requires a close read and a somewhat deep understanding of Malcolm's history. To the lay reader, they'll miss a lot of important things, including the way Marable tries to redefine what the OAAU's goal was. Because this is part of, as I'll get to in just a minute, Marable's desire, as we said also at the beginning, to liberalize Malcolm X, because the living, breathing Malcolm couldn't live in this world. The ideas that Malcolm represented also as living, breathing ideas can't exist in this world either. So the OAAU is used, at least in one instance that I'll use for my example now, by Marable to explain how really what he's doing is he's trying to say that Obama's election in 2008 was a culmination of what Malcolm was saying in his ballot to the bullet speech, his ballot or the bullet speech, that black people voting for Obama in 2008 was equivalent, according to Marable, to what Malcolm was saying about organizing black people as independent voters to vote for politicians who would defend the black community. So Marable actually truncates quotes from the OAAU. He quotes the first half of their statement about voting where Malcolm says, we're going to organize black voters into independent blocks to vote for candidates. And then Marable leaves it there, leaving out the part where Malcolm talked about, because we are not going to vote for black face leaders who will be imposed on us to carry out the white supremacist capitalistic plans of our political and cultural enemies. And we are not going to just vote for a Democratic or Republican party. We are literally going to be legitimately independent voters who vote only for those who will observably and demonstrably defend our rights and our conditions and our communities. Of course, he leaves out all the part about Malcolm's, the original name of the OAAU, which, as William Sayles tells us in the 1990s in a book that Marable and his defenders say we must dismiss, that it was going to be the Afro-American Freedom Fighters, and they were going to be the above-ground group of the Revolutionary Action Movement, who would be the underground guerrilla warfare group. But they told him, no, calm down that name, because you're going to give us away. So he changed it to the OAAU. And, of course, he has to ignore Malcolm's continued to the day he died defense of self-defense is nonviolence and armed self-defense and guerrilla warfare training and rifle group training. All of that is ignored by Manning Marable as he tries to transition Malcolm X into what he calls a race-neutral Pan-Africanist. Mary Baraka's piece we've included in this book, though it was not original to us, in part because of what we thought was his important question that he asked about the consciousness that produced this work. And if any of you, I don't know if you all listen to Democracy Now! At all, if any of you heard his debate, or his exchange with Dyson, that was hilarious. Well, what he summarized in those discussions is his essay in this book, which is basically where Baraka was saying, Marable was a democratic socialist. He was not a revolutionary Marxist or Leninist. So his discussion of Malcolm's anti-imperialism was one that was born outside of the crucible of black radical tradition and black nationalism, and outside the crucible of revolutionary Marxism and Leninism. And that as a democratic socialist, you have to support, even as Baraka does, supporting Obama or sort of mainstream electoral politics, and you have to turn away from radical nationalism and radical anti-imperialism. And so Baraka, in this very important question, is asking, how could Marable appreciate the anti-imperialism and the black nationalism of a Malcolm X coming from a democratic socialist perspective? Dyson, in the argument, says, well, how are you going to quote dead white men in part of your complaint against a black man writing, you know, not well enough about a radical black man? And which, of course, is not the point. That was just, I think that was just a quick way of Dyson exposing himself as not being conversant in that language or that history. and wanting to dismiss Baraka's argument. But of course, Baraka's not saying we should love dead white guys. He's just saying, as a point of analysis, you have to understand where Marable is coming from. And if you understand the difference between revolutionary Marxism and Leninism and democratic socialism or democratic socialist parties, which as Baraka reminds us, Lenin called traitors or something to that effect, then you would understand why Marable would write the way he has written about Malcolm and these more radical tendencies that Malcolm was at least engaging with. My colleague, Dr. Burroughs, raises a couple of issues in his coda that I wanted to sort of wrap up our discussion of at least a little bit here, where he talks about being at a panel on Marable's book in New York and basically being dismissed as he tried to raise a question. And like one of our other contributors, Greg Thomas, raises this question of branding and saying that Marable has branded a new Malcolm X that prevents us from accessing the real Malcolm X. And of course, what is a brand? What is the function of a brand? And of course, a brand's function is to deny the reality of the process behind the creation of a product or what the product is really here to do or who benefits from it. It is to disassociate people from the realities of what created something and just to simply make them want it and to buy it or to support its the process that produced it. So, you know, the Nike swoosh is not meant to make you think of the 10-year-old Indonesian girl whose lungs are exploding from the glue that puts all the stuff together. It's meant to make you think of high performance and style, right? So that's what we're arguing has been done to Malcolm through this Viking Press and Manning Marable book. What I add to that discussion, just very briefly, is this question of what is the impact of the brand in terms of us even being able to discuss not only Marable's book but Malcolm X. And part of what I try to write about very briefly is that I have tried to debate all of the living researchers who put their name on this book. Not just me, but I'll speak from my own experience. I'm one of several who have tried to do this. And in each case, those attempts have been turned down. I invited Zahir Ali to my radio show. I contacted him and said, he's a lead researcher, by the way, sorry. And I said, I will provide for you weeks in advance in writing the questions I will ask, and hopefully that will give you and your colleagues time to develop your answers and be ready to respond so that nobody feels ambushed on the air, nobody feels like, you know, then, you know, we can have a real good discussion, and hopefully I can just get some questions answered. He never responded, and the one time we were on a TV program together, it only happened because the producer did not tell him I was going to be there, or that my colleague would be there, and it was too late for him to back out. And he would not sit with us in the green room. He would not meet with us before, at all. He had a whole separate, We had a very polite exchange on the program. And then afterwards, I asked him about this invitation. And he said, well, I'm not going to do that. He made it clear that that was not a possibility. And on several other occasions when we had been slated to appear on panels together, where he would have been paid very well to be there, he backed out at the last minute once he saw that my name was being added to the event. This happened three times with me alone. And so my point is that even though Manning Marable is given credit, and as I think it's probably fair to say of him, that he would have welcomed exchange and criticism of his book, those who walk in his footsteps and benefit in terms of their career from walking in his footsteps will not engage in principled exchange or principled dialogue or principled debate. They are shutting down the debate so that their branded Malcolm X stands alone. Marable, again, from his class position with Columbia University, and Margot Arnold's piece in our book is a very strong one talking about the relationship of Columbia University and the struggle over the Audubon Ballroom, that she adds, works nicely into her discussion of the way, as she says, Marable has given our black radical consciousness the blues. Marable has diminished the black radicalism of Malcolm X, the tendencies to deal with anti-imperialism, socialism, black nationalism, radical pan-Africanism, all of those ideologies are diminished. He assaults in drive-by fashion, people like Kwame Nkrumah, who impacted Malcolm X, trying to walk us away from the radicalism of an Nkrumah. And what would that mean in the 21st century if you had a United States of Africa? Maybe Obama's plans to bomb Libya and set up AFRICOM, as he has done, would not succeed. And this is sort of part of what the argument that we're trying to make in this book also is that by the epilogue or the end of the book, by the book's end, you read Marable's final words on what he is trying to do or how he is trying to leave us or what kind of Malcolm X he's trying to leave us with. And again, this is one, a version of Malcolm that is put with Obama, Condoleezza Rice, and Colin Powell, and and pitted against the radical Islam and Al-Qaeda in particular, Muslim Brotherhood as well. In the epilogue, he actually says, Osama bin Laden called Powell, Rice, and Obama sellouts because they were not like Malcolm X. That can't stand because readers of this book, this New York Times best-selling Pulitzer Prize-winning book, could not be left with a Malcolm X that would have been critical of what the United States has done in the world, that would have raised questions, of chickens coming home to roost when revisiting the 9/11 incident, if we believe the standard story of 9/11. So what he has to do is he has to put Malcolm in the Condoleezza, Obama, Powell camp in opposition to the radical Islam of Al-Qaeda and the Muslim Brotherhood, so that unwitting readers of the book will walk away with this idea that Obama and Rice and Powell are legitimate extensions of Malcolm X. And again, don't take my word for it. Read the epilogue carefully. This is what Marable is doing, because you can't sell books about Malcolm X if you would raise questions that I think Malcolm would have more likely raised about his concerns about the West's relationship with the Islamic world and so on and so forth, or where Malcolm would have more likely been in a camp that was at least quietly, though I know he softened his public criticism of black leaders by the end of his life, but he would have at least quietly been critical, and he certainly would not have stood with warmongers like Obama, Rice, and Powell. He would not have done that. I think it's fair to say he would not have done that. Certainly, Viking Press would not want to publish a book that would disassociate, as I think is appropriate to do, Malcolm X from our current black political leadership. And even if you like Obama, which I don't, and we can talk about that too if you want, but even if you like Obama, I think it's fair to say you can't say he's part of the political extension or the lineage of a Malcolm X. You could say it, I don't think you could prove it. So this is what the book has to do. This is what Marable ultimately ends up doing. And as I'll conclude here with this question, as I always try to ask, why propaganda, again going back to Fanon, is because, as Fanon said, the settler's work is to make even dreams of liberty impossible for the native, and the native's work is to imagine all possible methods for destroying the settler. And I think what Marable and Viking Press have done here is to give us a version of Malcolm X that would deny us even the ability to dream of our liberty and certainly to organize for the destruction of the settler.
That was Morgan State University Communications Professor Jared Ball speaking at the IKG Cultural Center in Washington. The Black is Back Coalition for Social Justice, Peace, and Reparations holds a national conference in Newark, New Jersey on August 18th with a focus on electoral politics. Black is Back Chairman Omali Yeshitela.
We expect to have a very serious discussion around the question of elections, taking it beyond just the very subjective issue of Barack Obama, but the question of the role of elections in this kind of society and the role of money, whether or not the monopoly of the ruling class can be broken around the electoral process, and how and whether black people should be involved.
Well, of course, the Black is Back Coalition came into existence in 2009 in part to show that not all black folks were supportive of this corporate Democrat.
Indeed. And I think that in many ways I see the Black is Back Coalition as having been the organization, the group of organizations working together that threw its body on the grenade, so to speak, because it was a very unpopular in some circles question to raise about whether or not Obama could be supported or trusted or whether he was just another Democratic Party shill. Today, we see that there are fewer people who would challenge our argument, though there are some steadfast Obama loyalists who, regardless of the legitimacy of the question, would still be there with him. But I think the thing about the Black is Back Coalition is that it represents a variety of different organizations and personalities and and philosophies, and I believe that it is a representative of an incipient stance in our community, especially if the community has the benefit of scientific and rational discussion around the question, as opposed to simply being jerked around by our emotions, as has been the case up to now.
And of course, the Black is Back Coalition is not opposed to participation in principle in the electoral system at certain junctures, but wants to talk to folks about treating voting like some kind of religion.
That is a problem because, you know, we hear people who often say, regardless of who the candidate is, that we fought and we died, we bled for the right to vote. And I think that's really misstating the issue, because what we fought and bled and died for was a struggle for freedom, and the vote was seen by many of us at a particular time as to be an appropriate vehicle through which that could be pursued. But the idea of voting just to be voting is not something that any rational person obviously would have been engaged in a struggle for. So no, we're not opposed in principle to the issue of using the electoral process, but the question is whether we use the electoral process or whether we are used by it. And I think that's the stance that the Black is Back Coalition is raising up and asking people to approach this question of election as calmly and scientifically and as rationally as we would any other question, regardless of who the candidate happens to be at any given moment.
We've had 3.5 years of this administration. How, in general, do you think the presence of a Black person in the White House has affected the Black polity, its behavior?
I think at this point it has been powerfully negative in how it has impacted on how people have mobilized. If you remember, the Black is Back Coalition was the first Black mobilization to demonstrate against the Obama regime. We were the first national mobilization to have done that. And up to now, I have not even heard of another Black organization that has led opposition to what the Obama regime is involved in. And when you look at Obama, we see many folk obviously paralyzed because Obama's policies have been actually literally worse for us and for peoples around the world than the Bush regime, the policies of Bush, whom so many of us were obviously and viscerally opposed to. So to see this silence, to see this inactivity, to see many of the people who had been viewed as champions of the rights of the oppressed, of Black people, simply crawl into bed with Obama and absolutely refuse to raise any criticism is a powerful indictment to the state of Black leadership at this juncture. And beyond that, some of them are actually actively engaged as water carriers for Obama, the Sharptons and many others, this guy Eric Dyson, there's just a crew of them. And in many ways, I really believe that's a good thing because I think the community needs to be able to make some kinds of decisions beyond just some kind of race loyalty, which has locked us into the Obama, but across the board. Because we've seen Black elected officials bomb our communities, and we've seen them in various cities and places that have functioned in much more oppressive, or at least as oppressively as any white politicians. And I think that right now, the way forces are lining up inside our community will give us an excellent opportunity to separate the wheat from the chaff. I think that's how it's said.
And in fact, we've seen a proliferation of a kind of Obama clone in Black American politics.
Indeed, there are clones that are out there. And again, I really believe that that's going to be a good thing, depending on whether we, that is to say, the Black is Black Coalition and those honest and legitimate progressive forces would draw a line in the sand that separates that kind of opportunistic, self-serving politic from the kind of politic that has historically been leading our communities from a very high moral standpoint, so to speak. I think that that's going to be one of the benefits of how things are shaping up right now. And I think of this August 18th, Newark, New Jersey event around the question of Obama and the elections and whether or not we can pursue the issues of social justice, peace, and Black power through the electoral process and give us an opportunity to discuss this with some science in a very dispassionate way.
And of course, Newark, New Jersey is the home of one of the major affiliates of the Black is Back Coalition, the People's Organization for Progress.
And that's one of the other really important reasons. I mean, because that, the stance of the People's Organization for Progress, is the stance that I think represents the historical progressive stance of our community, and that which has to be emulated, and another reason why it's important to be there. And of course, Newark has its own history, as does New Jersey, of resistance and raising up the critical questions important for our people and for our community. But I agree with you. I think that the People's Organization Progress is just an incredible manifestation of the kind of politics that we want to hold up in opposition to what Obama and the Obama clones represent in the world.
Could you give us some examples of electoral contests that Black folks should be actively engaged in?
I think there are a number of them, and I think they come in all forms. And one example I believe that was extremely important was the case of Charles Barron out there in Brooklyn, who ran for Congress. And so we saw all the guns of the Democratic Party and the ruling class come out against him, characterizing him as anti-Semitic and anti-white and any other number of ways. But I think that Barron has an incredibly important track record, one that has always attempted to raise up the important questions for our folk. And so there's a way that Barron might have won the election, certainly as far as the Black community is concerned. Then there are cases like what we've seen happening in Jackson, Mississippi, with Chokwe Lumumba, who won a seat on the city council and now is running for mayor there. And then there are various kinds of measures which can be put on the ballot. California is an excellent example of that, where some affiliates of ours in the past have put housing measures on the ballot that actually shook the establishment so much that one ruling class newspaper wrote that if this measure passes on the ballot on Monday, then the then governor would bomb, would order an airstrike on Oakland on Tuesday. So I think that there are various venues that we can use. And then not just here in the United States. We've been engaged, an affiliate of the Black is Back Coalition in Nassau, the Bahamas, running for parliament, raising up critical questions which are significant to our community and challenging the corporate status quo, whether that's here in the United States or whether that's in other places around the world. So I think that there are a lot of opportunities for us to be involved. And I think that depending on the level of organization that we achieve, we can even involve ourselves in presidential politics. And the other thing I would remind everybody of, that sometimes not voting is as powerful as actually going to the poll. That is to say that sometimes a boycott of an election when there are no options given to us except to vote for the system itself, sometimes not voting can prove to be a very powerful thing, especially if it's an organized determination not to vote that is clearly political. I think that most African people, or many in this country, participate through the boycott anyway. Just don't call it that. Just don't see anybody that there is to vote for. And despite having fought for the vote for such a long period of time, won't do it because there's nothing to vote for. As Malcolm X said, no matter who you vote for, you end up losing. And that's one of the contradictions. That's one of the things I think can be so important about this conference that we're doing on August 18th, because I think that we can collectively establish some criteria that we can make a judgment of anyone who's running for office and the kinds of questions that they have to entertain in order to win the support of our communities. So even a general, broad kind of agenda that should be fought for during this era. I think that's one of the things that makes this Black is Back Coalition August 18th conference so important.
This Black president, often referred to as a son of Africa, along with the U.S.'s NATO allies, launched an attack against and overthrew the government of Libya. Were you surprised at the lack of a Black American reaction?
I was actually not surprised. And many people who had previously been considered pro-Gaddafi, supportive of that government in Africa, found themselves at the same time in bed with Obama. And they were immobilized effectively because of that relationship, and that relationship has trumped. In a way, it has revealed them as a certain kind of red, black, and green, if you will, patriots. They are U.S. patriots wearing red, black, and green colors. And some of these are, you know, well-known forces. Some of them have been recipients of monies and resources from Gaddafi, and if not money and resources, certain an element of prestige because of their association with the Gaddafi government. So in many ways, I was not surprised at all. There was a deafening silence. And one of the one has been certainly a huge recipient of Gaddafi and is clearly basking in a relationship with the Obama regime. So it is nauseating, and it is clearly time. When we're looking at what we see with Obama is a manifestation of a certain rot that has been able to establish itself as leadership of our community, and Obama is just one manifestation of that. There are others, and these, many of them are not even elected. They've elected themselves as representatives of our people.
And many of those who seem to acquiesce in the assault on Libya and other assaults by the United States and its allies in Africa call themselves members of the black left.
They do call themselves that. And some of them have been forces that I have been proud to work with and be associated with in the past. That is no longer the case. And some of them, while not part of the black left, have been considered by many as certainly as a part of a kind of nationalist black opposition in this country that, despite being tied to certain kinds of religious obscurantism, seemed to many to be representative of the well-being of black people in general. But all of that is gone away. And I think, again, that it's becoming increasingly important for us to be clear in our stance that we're not just talking about an Obama. We're not just talking about a handful of black politicians, but in fact, there is a certain kind of rot of misleadership of our community that must be replaced. As much as we're talking about replacing the notion that Barack Obama represents the interests of our people, I think that we have to be clear that there is a leadership rot across the board that also has to be displaced and discredited as representatives of our folk.
Omali Yeshitela of the Black is Back Coalition. Afia Wangaza is an active participant in the Black is Back Coalition from Greenville, South Carolina. Wangaza is an attorney and founder of Greenville's Malcolm X Center and its community radio station, WMXP-FM. She says $15,000 is needed, like right now, to bring the station to full power.
We're in the process of moving the tower. The base has been secured, and we expect the contractor to begin stacking the additional or sections of the tower to the base over the next 10 days, at which point he will be expecting us to pay him $15,000.
WMXP has been involved in the black political struggle in Greenville and the surrounding regions of South Carolina for a long time.
That's correct. We've used WMXP Community Radio 95.5 FM to extend the voice of not just the Malcolm X grassroots movement in Greenville, but also to extend the voice of the Uhuru movement as part of our regular programming on Sundays from 10 until 5, we simulcast the Uhuru radio station, which brought a significant political analysis and perspective to the community. In addition to that, we bring into the community other voices. We, of course, broadcast Black Agenda Report commentary throughout the day. We bring in other such programming from around the country in order to connect the local community with the national and indeed international black community and provide an opportunity for political education in a way that it would not otherwise be available. The antenna is only sitting 20 feet off of the ground, which means we have very, very limited coverage. We have listeners even now and people making comments about the information that they are receiving, in addition to which we, of course, have live programming. We were able to broadcast the Malcolm X Festival this year live from the historically segregated Cleveland Park in downtown Greenville. So it's a lifeline. It provides an opportunity for members of the community to not only learn how to operate a radio station, discovering which side of the microphone is most important. It also provides an opportunity for people in the community to talk to each other and to raise questions through open forums, an opportunity to challenge elected officials, appointed officials, as well as each other as to what next steps we must be taking in order to advance the interest of African people.
And it's also been an opportunity for you to get in trouble with the powers that be.
It's been a very effective opportunity for me to get in trouble. At first, they really didn't understand that it was, as they say, a real radio station. They thought it was a ham radio station, and they said that we didn't need a permit in order to put up our tower. And then when they discovered, as they say, a real radio station, then they, of course, immediately told us that we had to take it down. And we went the rounds about that for 4 years. But it has made them more mindful of controlling the communications medium in the Black community. Not just in terms of radio, but in terms of even the local newspaper and their challenges to the publisher as to the kind of stories that he publishes with regard to the Black community. I call it the Don't Worry, Be Happy sheet, because he even hesitates to publish notices, the Kwanzaa events, Malcolm X Festival, when it's going to occur, the Retreat for a Black Agenda. So without the radio station, we have no way of having a meaningful, substantive, significant political voice in this community. Without the radio station, we have no opportunity for independent thought, independent action, independent programming.
So to keep the work of WMXP going, you need money, and how can people get it to you?
Donations can be made on the web at WMXP955.com. There is a donate button for PayPal and a donate button by click and pledge. We have sent out a call asking that people would donate at least $5. Snail mail would be Post Office Box 16102, Greenville, South Carolina, 29607. Again, that's Post Office Box 16102, Greenville, South Carolina, 29607. Website address, again, is WMXP955.com. Donations are tax deductible.
And when you get this tower up, how large would your area of coverage be?
We will reach up to 100,000 people. We will reach the entire Black community of the city and most of the county of Greenville, which is another point of concern, obviously, because great pains have been taken to dissipate the electoral base of the Black community, to scatter us around the perimeter of the city in pockets, so that it has had a deleterious impact with regard to redistricting, with regard to communication, with regard to community support, that and extended families. It's just abominable. And the station thwarts that effort. So having been in the first cycle of low-power FM stations, we were able to get a frequency which puts us right in the middle of the city and which covers broadly enough to reach all of the Black community. So it's a weapon. It is clearly a weapon that can serve to defend our interests on one hand and to serve as a shield and a sword, to put it shortly.
And that's it for this week's Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network, and especially to our engineer, Myron Bitts.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.